Tory Way, Northwest London, Friday, the 18th of January, Zion Schrott, Rabbi Dr. Zvi Belovsky, Exodus and the Scourge of Idolatry.
Thank you, good morning. The original email said it was called Exodus and the Scourge or Idolatry, but I fortunately corrected that. This week's Parsha, including the Shrine of the Exodus, refers to the need, as perhaps the primary theological objective of the Exodus, to destroy the gods of Egypt. Varati beres Mitzrayim balayla hazeh, possibly that we all know, I shall pass through the land of Egypt on that night, v'kesi chol b'chorei be'eretz Mitzrayim, and I will strike every firstborn in the land of Egypt, me odom v'ad behemo, whether man or beast. V'chol Elohei Mitzrayim is the key part, and against all the gods of Egypt, Ezesh Votim, I shall execute judgment. And this theme, this posuk, of course, is used in the Haggadah, and the theme of the destruction of the gods of Egypt as one of the central themes is prevalent in this parasha in references to Yetzias Mitzrayim elsewhere in Tanakh, and particularly on Seder night. Ani Hashem, I am God. So the first thing is, it seems to be very important that it is done directly, and the expansion of this posuk in the Haggadah focuses primarily on the fact that God is doing it directly, v'lo yayudei shaliach. In fact, that's how Rashi explains the posuk. Esesh fotin, ani Hashem, it seems to be redundant. God is speaking, esesh fotin, I will execute judgment. So why does the posuk need to say ani Hashem? To emphasize, says Rashi, ani v'atzmi, v'loy al yudei shaliach. I'm doing it on my own, it's just me, and in each posuk that ani, it's ani v'loy sorath, ani v'loy malach, v'chule, v'chule, we know that's the theme. Why is it so central? A, the destruction of the idolatry of Egypt. After all, the goal is to get them out of Egypt, to punish the Egyptians for what they've done wrong, and to enable the Bnei Yisrael to begin their independent life and ultimately be capable of receiving the Torah, which is the objective. Why is it so important, uvachol Elohei Mitzrayim eseh shvotim? So, I suppose it's self-evident, really, that the primary issa in the Torah, once all Isurim are really focused, is lo yelachol. Is there going to be no other gods? That the most difficult thing for human beings to understand, and certainly in the ancient world, is there is only one power, Eino Milvadoi. There is nothing else at all in the universe. Whether we are an illusion, and everything in this world is an illusion, or whether we have some kind of reality, despite that, that's a disagreement. It's a disagreement perhaps between the Baal HaTanya and the Vilna Gaon, and various others, but lemaisa eino milvadoi. The trouble is that human beings have always detected multiple forces. They see powerful forces of nature that seem to be in contradiction with each other, and human beings have always had a tendency, at the very least, to dualism. That means they think there are positive forces and negative forces, and mostly to polytheism, to understand there are multiple gods and powers. And the central theme, the central achievement of monotheism, Avraham Avinu's relationship, understanding there is only one power, there's a Motsu Rishon, first cause, and eventually the nation that he produces, Bnei Yisrael, that is going to be the primary understanding and relationship with the one God, and the utter rejection at all levels of any kind of multiplicity. And therefore, against their gods, the powers the Egyptians believed in, coming away from that, if we're going to be born goy mikerev goy, it's essential not just that we are physically separate, but what they believe in, their ideology, is also destroyed. Let's look at some other aspects of the issue. In Parsha Shemois, we see the beginning of the mission of Moshe Rabbeinu, and his initial unwillingness to accept the mission. What's the reason he accepts, he refuses to accept the mission, ostensibly, maybe a whole range of reasons, but the stated reason is, ki chvad peh uchvad loshoin onuchi. I don't speak clearly. There are, of course, multiple interpretations of this. As an aside, it's irresistible. There's a Rashbam, a very famous Rashbam, you know, the Pashtun par excellence. The Rashbam says, I'm not a good guy to send to the Bnei Yisroel, because I don't speak Egyptian, very clearly. It's already many years since I left. I left as a young man. I ran away from Egypt. I've lived abroad for many years. I've lost my fluency in Egyptian. And therefore, unfortunately, I'm not going to be a good agent to speak to people in Egyptian. I think we understand that that's not the mainstream interpretation. Here, it's understood, the Rashbam rejects this, but the standard interpretation based on the Midrash, Rashi understands that he stammers. He has a speech impediment, and we are familiar with the Midrash that lies behind this about him taking the cold and putting it in his mouth. But that's the Hefer Timtza. Lemaisa, he speaks about it, although the Rashbam says it's completely unthinkable, absolutely unthinkable, that the man that Kodesh Baruch Hu sends to speak to the Pharaoh is incapable of communicating clearly. The mainstream view is not like that. He doesn't speak clearly. And we see again, it repeats itself again, beginning of Vayera and last week's Parsha, there's a lot of emphasis on this speech defect. He rejects the mission again. I don't want to go to Pharaoh, and if the Bnei Yisrael are hardly going to listen to me, if Yishmo'eni Pharaoh, I am of uncircumcised, Rashi means closed, I stammer. So, why are we focusing on this? Because there are famously the Maharal speaks about conceptual understanding of the Rebbeinu's speech defects. Understand that it represents the inability of his spiritual component to properly relate to the physical and spiritual don't work, if you like, in tandem. But perhaps the most important philosophical understanding appears in the Drosha Saram, Drosha Shlishi. So he calls that Drosha Shlishi. And the Ram gives an important theological understanding of Moshe Rabbeinu's speech defect. He asks the obvious question, how can it be that the man who is sent to speak, the man who has to have the gravitas, who's got to be persuasive, is going to take 2 million people out into the desert in the spring, the man who's going to lead them out of Egypt, out of their comfort zone, and then deal with all their problems, how could it be that this man can't speak properly? And he says, in fact, that you would expect the Navi to have every possible type of shlemus. That's very much based on the Rambam's kind of understanding of the nature of the Navi as the perfect human being. And he gives three characteristics for a Navi. One is that he has good midas. Another is that he is a spiritual, capable person. And he said, after that, number three is communicator. In fact, he said the word Navi comes from the word Nivsat Osayim. Someone who can articulate properly. A Navi is a speaker. So how does this happen? So he says, a very important message for all time. Never believe in demagogues. There are people who are good speakers, who are convincing demagogues, who can convince people of things that aren't true. Well, Azois HaSiba, for this reason, Nishlam Moshe, the whole Shlemus Novi Lahamin, Jenny Kirk Eloya, Vahusam in Menu Ashkokas, Vahusar in Menu Ashkok, Gomorrah Diva Natsah. He was perfect in every way, except the capacity to speak, to articulate clearly, was denied him. Why? Lamano Yeshev Yosef, the Kalal Bene Sugdulem Nim Shokim Acharov. So people would not be drawn after him. They would come to confuse the message with the messenger. You need to make sure you listen to the message. And don't get carried away with the charisma. Kamoshi Adua, and he says, as it's known. Shema al-Mishu Tzachadir, but people say about someone who's a great communicator, Shimshoch leiv ha-homan acharov. People will be drawn after him. Va-shekem v'meni yashar emes. And such a person can persuade his audience that lies are true. So to prevent that happening, it was necessary in the primary capability, the primary communication to people, listen, what's he saying? The only thing they can hear is the message. They will not get caught up with the message, particularly if you put yourself in the mindset of people who have become used to a certain type of leader, Parai, I will come back to in a moment, as all leaders of the ancient world, and even some today, put themselves as infallible, they're gods. We have to break that mindset. The leader is at best a powerful and accurate communicator of the divine will. He is not, chas v'sholom, the divine. And therefore, in the process of destroying the notion of Avodah Zorah and emphasizing the monotheism on which everything we believe is based, it is essential to prevent even the slightest possibility that even the great leader will be confused with the divine himself. This run is extremely important. Some of you may know it. It's extremely important. It's actually a longer piece. And it's quite clear that the idea that charismatic figures can lead people into who knows what is not something new. The run is writing about it in the 14th century, and it's been known throughout history. To prevent that happening, you see as well later on, what's the a mainstream understanding of why we don't know Moshe Lo Yoda Eskubiyasoi, why don't we know where he's buried, so that his burial place will not become a shrine, it will not become a place of idolatry. You can never imagine, for example, people queuing up to go to graves, anything like that. That would never happen, and so on. But to prevent that happening here, as it says in the Chizkuni, first of all, we don't want anyone to be buried next to it. It'll happen, someone important gets buried, everyone wants to buy the plots next to them. So no one will be able to buy the plot next to Moshe Rabbeinu. As you saw, it happened in Beis El later on. And also, the Shoalei Mesim, necromancers, will not go and do stuff there which is forbidden. So it's best we shouldn't know where he's buried. There is always a tendency to idolise the leader. Let no one idolise Moshe Rabbeinu, the great leader. And you see the same theme as well in the beginning of the mission. It's in last week's Parsha. So how Lechel Paro, last week, Barboike, go to Pharaoh in the morning. In Yetzer Maimor, he's going to go out to the water. We're going to discuss it in a minute. Why does he go out to the water? And stand there, but it's up to, isn't more than stand. It's stand defiantly. And stand yourself defiantly to greet him, al sfas hayoir, or the edge of the river. And take the stick that you turned into a snake in your hand. Why go out there in the early in the morning? And the Rashi is, I mean, it's slightly amusing, but actually beneath this Rashi lies a very profound idea. Rashi says, why does he go out in the morning? Likovov, he goes out to perform his normal bodily functions that everyone has to perform in the morning. Sha'osa atzmoi eloya, because he had made himself into a god. We didn't read the Haftorah of Vayu this year because it was Shabbos Rosh Chodesh. But in the Haftorah from Yecheskel, Ani Yoyri, Va'ani Asisin, these are machlokes Rishonim, what the phrase means. But some say it means, I am the Nile and I made it. And some Rishonim say it means, I am the Nile and I made myself. I am a god. I am self-justifying. And this is the theme today, when they appoint a new emperor in Japan. Which doesn't matter, they tend to be quite long-lived, it doesn't happen very often. But when they appoint a new emperor, they still have some ritual where he goes into a special room where he has some kind of liaison with some spirit, and this confers upon him some kind of godliness. I don't know if any Japan actually believes that the emperor is divine, But it's not very long since ago since people were encouraged to believe that those ideas still were. But in the ancient world, it was normal. So he has to go around the back of the palace because no one can see him having the normal bodily needs. You can't watch him eat. You can't watch him doing anything. All you ever see him is in that throne, and he gives the impression he's there all the time. But in the meantime, of course, he's a normal human being, and he has to go round the back of the palace, to where the river runs behind the palace, to relieve himself. So, by making himself a good, you say that he does not have any normal bodily needs. He gets up early in the morning, down to the Nile, and that's where he did it, because he has to be out of sight. So you have to imagine what happened. Moshe and Aaron are being encouraged. This is the spot. No one knows anything about it. Hide behind the bush. And just at the right moment, pop up and say, good morning, Pharaoh. Right, nice to see you. Which is the beginning of saying, the game's up. We know who you are. We know you're a human being like us. And soon everyone else is going to know that as well. And that's the very first moment, the very first plague encounter, to announce what's going to happen. I know it seems very amusing, I know, and I often speak about this, and it's kind of, you know, it's quite amusing, this image, but actually, the breaking the notion of that a human being, or any other entity in this world, could have characteristics of the divine, is part of the process of a chol Elohim Mitzrayim eseh shvatim. I have to execute judgment against all the gods of Egypt. And Pharaoh and the Nile are number one. And of course, many sources say that is why the early Makos are directed against the Nile. Not just because it's the water source, Egypt is dependent on the Nile rather than rain, but also because it's an object of their worship. Every concept that there can be a force, whether it's a human being, whether it's an item in nature, whether it's an object of any sort, could have any power, has to be destroyed in order that B'nai Yisrael will walk away, not just impressed by the magnitude of the Makkos, but convinced of the theological underpinnings of them, that there is only one God. That is what's going on here. That as passing through Egypt means not just to punish the Egyptians, it means to emphasise that the very basis of their religious beliefs are flawed. I mean, you know, if you look in the Barbanel and the other Purushim and the Haggadah, that's where they say the sages on the 15th of Nisan, because it's the middle of the month at which the Simum, the zodiac sign on which Egypt focuses, the land, is at its zenith. It's the middle of the month. It's the full moon of the month of Aries. And that's when it's absolutely the zenith, that's when it's brought down. That creates the greatest impression that God overpowers it. I think the Barbanel talks about this, Haggadah, and other places. So that is absolutely essential. It's essential. Going back to Parshas Vayechi, Vayikruyu Mei Yisrael Omus, and the days of Yisrael Yaakov drew near to dying. Vayikroliv Noli Yosef, Vayem Eloi, he called his son Yosef, and he said to him, if I find favor in your eyes, Sidno Yodchotat Zirechi, place your hand beneath my thigh, it means make an oath. Vosiso Imodi Chesed Emes, and perform kindness and truth for me. Al Nosik Barinu Mitzrayim. Don't bury me in Egypt. Why? Well, there are various Midrashic interpretations quoted by Rashi as well. Dov Acher, Ma Bikesh Yaakov Avinu Shelo Yekovet B'Mitzrayim. Why did Yaakov desire not to be buried in Egypt? Shelo Yasu Oisoi Avodas Kechovim. So the issue that one said doesn't fancy the life, but this is an interesting interpretation, because he's alarmed. And it seems in terms of the themes, this seems to be perhaps, I think, the central, the most faithful to the text. The entire purpose will ultimately be to refute, destroy, and completely undermine idolatry. If you bury me in Egypt, if I'm there, I'll become a shrine. I'm the man that when I turned up, the waters rose to greet me. I'm the man when I read the famine stopped and so on, in that kind of world, I will very quickly become an idol. It's a temporary matter, and there's a tradition that he's not even buried there at all. You know, whatever, you know, he's not buried there at all. Even for a moment, he's coming, they embalm him, and they get him straight out. And Yosef, it's a big deal for Yosef to do this, but he has to commit himself to do it because he's worried. You put him there, all of the red string people are going to be out the next day, and it's going to become kind of idolatry. So there's a very, very strong theme: Egypt and the refutation of idolatry. You can even go further. The precise nature of idolatry is always unclear. You know, we can speculate, but there's a lot about Ra in Jewish sources and in non-Jewish sources about Ra being this kind of force of Egypt, what it represents, a certain type of fatalism, a certain type of idolatry. What is also a common theme, and you see that throughout Chazal, before I move on to the next bit, is that there's a fear of dualism. Dualism is really the primary concern. So dualism was a popular form of ancient idolatry. It still exists in the form of Zoroastrianism, Manichaeism, or types of religions where they believe not in multiple gods, but in two. They cannot come to terms with the notion that good and bad can come from the same source. So we have a basic principle, and we have to grapple with it. It's very difficult for any thinking human being, the notion that good and bad can come from the same source, which is ultimately essential if you're a monotheist, is a very difficult idea, but nonetheless it is absolutely central to every Jewish belief. But you can understand, without that emphasis on monotheism, the most credible, the most likely, and perhaps theologically persuasive alternative is dualism, where you have a good of a God and a good of bad. And you can see traces of this in Chazal. What Chazal were concerned about was not so much polytheism, but dualism. How do you see that? Ose Shalom, what's the rest of the Pasuk? We say Bereshit Kol, but that has been bolderized. That's not the original text. The Pasuk in Shas, Ose Shalom Vore Ra. And what Chazal concerned about? That people would end up seeing that we were acknowledging two forces. So the purpose of the tefillah, for straightforward people who perhaps weren't so okay with the theological issues, they changed it. Ha'oma moidim moidim. Shatskinosai. If you hear a shliach tzibur, it's obviously reflecting a concern of the era of the Mishnah, or slightly before. Someone says moidim moidim. Shatskinosai. What's that about? Doesn't say modim, 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 modim. Two modims. The concern that the Shliach Tzibur will be a closet dualist, of course, of Avodah Zarah, that dualism, and would be privately acknowledging the power of both. You hear someone say modim, modim, doesn't mean he stumbles over the words. It means that he's acknowledging, and there's a similar one with Shema as well. There are concerns about Chazan. Interestingly, it's in more detail for another time. The Orach HaShulchan has a fascinating pirush on the Haggadah called Leil Shimurim. And in his Haggadah, he has a very lengthy analysis of Echo Miodea. By the time he gets to Echo Miodea, most Haggadahs, the Mephoshim have given up. By the time they get to the Mir, they kind of ran out of steam. But he's got quite extensive pirushim on the end part of the Haggadah as well. And he sees, it's worth reading, isn't time to talk about in any detail, he sees the whole of Echad Miyodea as a test as to whether we, as a result of re-experiencing the Yetzias Mitzrayim, have succeeded in internalizing the notion of monotheism and rejecting dualism. And he sees each of them as a statement that we don't believe in dualism. It's complicated how he gets there, and most of them are quite convincing. One's a little forced, inevitably. He's got to get to 13. But actually, it's all about that. It's all about saying, we are monotheists and not dualists. This is not familiar. And we can probably say as well that that you see one other trace of that in Chazal is the story of Acher, Elisha ben Abuya. But exactly what happens to him, it's all a bit covered. You do sense there's been a little bit of a cover-up. I mean, there are never cover-ups in rabbinical circles, ever. But you would assume that perhaps in the time of Chazal, They had reasons for kind of being too explicit about exactly what happened to him. It's a very complicated story. But the core is that he can't attribute good and bad to the same source. He sees the child, he hears about this child who is performing his mitzvah, and the full child falls and dies, and he can't really attribute good and bad to the same source. And we might even say, Lahavdil, that the origins of Christianity are not that far away from this, about having different sources of good and bad. It may develop into three rather than two, but you probably prefer I didn't speak that about that in the Beis Medrash. But there's the idea. But all of those are inherent in what's going on in Egypt, what they experience, what they've come across, the way they've been encouraged to think, and what is lies in the pasuk of V'chol Eloheim Mitzrayim Eseh Shvatim. So to finish, let me tell you a fascinating addendum to this, which you may be familiar with in the Meshech Chochma. So it's the Meshech Chochma in, I believe, it's in Parshas Kisiso. So the pasuk says, "Vayikash yikrov al machaneh." As Moshe comes near to the machaneh, "Vayesho egel," he sees the egel choilos, and he sees them dancing around the egel. "Vayicha'af Moshe," and Moshe became angry. "Vayishleich miodoy es haluchos," and he threw the tablets from his hand. "Vayishaber oisom tachas v'hor," and he smashed them beneath the mountain. This is, one of the most powerful and also most represented images. So the Gemara says, no, he gets angry. There's no suggestion in the Pasuk that he's authorized to do this. Yet, says the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Pei Zayin, "Minal dehiskim HaKadosh Baruch Hu al Yodai." How do you know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu agreed? He agreed with what he did. Even if he didn't authorize it before, he approved. Shinemar, Asher Shibarto. Asher Shibarto. Later on, when they're making the second type, their lukos, which was Asher Shibarto. Asher Shibarto is read midrashically, Omeresh Lokish. Yiyasha Koikocho Sheshibarto. It's like a midrashic fiddle of the text. Well done for smashing the thousand. In fact, if you ever get in your Rashi, to the very last Rashi in the whole Torah, Rashi quotes this. At the very, very last rush in this whole Pirush Al HaTorah. Yasha Kocha Asher Shibarto. So well done for breaking the tablets. So it's a little difficult to square with the text. So there's a very important Meshech Chochma. A Meshech Chochma which is loved by rationalists, people who are very keen on the kind of Rambam's type approach. Rambam has a very, very pure, quite extreme understanding of what's permitted. Many of the things that have evolved, often based on other Rishonim, other approaches, the Rambam in his philosophical writing was almost certainly fighting against the Kuzari, a more mystical approach which was published soon before. But probably in terms of the Jewish world as we see it today, he lost this battle. But so the Meshech Chochma and others take up the baton. So he reads it the following. He has a fact, I haven't got time to read it, I'm just going to explain what he says. He says, what's the story? What's going on? He breaks the tablets. Well, who gives him, authorize him to break the tablets? Take the tablets, put them somewhere else, store them, take them back. Say, God, I'm sorry, they don't want them. What should I do with them? Ask what to do with them, return them, go back to base. But break them. This is supposed to be the holiest object ever brought into the world. It was intended to be encased in a special housing, an oran. All the things that go with it indicate, it seems to be, even for your Moshe Rabbeinu, this looks like a bit of a strange thing to do. And yet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu approves Yasher Kocho. So Mesimcha, the Meshech Chochma, says like this. He says, they come out of Egypt. They're worshipping this calf. Yes, we have all sorts of interpretations. It's not really Avodah Zorah, but Lamais, if you read the text at a straightforward level, there is Avodah Zorah at least at some level. They're harshly punished. Something's gone very badly wrong. So you have to understand the mindset. They have moved from all these monotheistic ideas that they've learned from the Exodus that we've been discussing, from Kabbalah's HaTorah, and suddenly they're doing this. What's going on? What's going on? So he says, it's quite understandable. They've reverted to type. They're under pressure. They don't know where God's gone. They know where their leader's gone. And what do you do under pressure? You revert to your original behaviour pattern. And you look for alternatives. they are on the brink of full-blown idolatry. If he brings the tablets, he brings the Luchos, these are made by God, they will immediately become an alternative focus for Avodah Zarah. So Meir Simcha, Moshe Rabbeinu realizes, given their state, given what's happened, he'll bring the Luchos, and they'll immediately transfer their allegiance from the Eagle to the Luchos, that will become full-blown idolatry, and the game's over, and they'll be destroyed. Moshe destroys the Luchos. He says in writing, he breaks the Luchos to save Klal Yisrael from idolatry. Because if they move from worship of the Eagle, which is dodgy, understandable, maybe it's a kind of alternative leadership figure, to an object which they know have come from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, they will worship this, and the game will be over. Yashikoch HaShesh Shibarto is recognizing the needs of the moment, which is they were teetering on falling back into full-blown idolatry, in which case they'd be unsavable. Yashikoch HaShesh Shibarto means Moshe took the incredibly bold and courageous step of smashing the Luchos to save Klal Yisrael from Avodah Zarah. Good morning. Good morning.